KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Near Eastridge.
Sunset.
Eastside, San Francisco.
Coming up, we'll go to the Coliseum BART station and meet the people always trying to get your attention as you walk to and from Warriors games.
I'm the horn player up here on the bridge that you hear bouncing and pumping, and you know, I'm your hype man when you leave.
A look at the underground economy on episode 2 of our new series, Bounce, following the Warriors' final season in Oakland. Then curator Michael Orange tells us how storytelling can help build community.
Everyone has a spectacular story, and there are no rules to your story. You can be as dusty as you'd like, or it can be as fanciful as you like.
How about dusty and fanciful? It's Cross Currents. It's Warriors Wednesday, and we're rolling out a new episode of our podcast, Bounce, following the final season for the Golden State Warriors in Oakland. Now, there's a lot to talk about, so I'm going to hand the mic over to our news director and host of Bounce, Ben Trefney.
There is Curry with his first shot.
It's the first round of the playoffs, Game 2 in Oakland against the LA Clippers. Golden State Warriors center DeMarcus Cousins pokes a ball away from an opposing player.
They don't call as many fouls. You can't be lazy on passes.
He hustles down the court, despite the injury that haunts his past. That injury, it's the only reason Cousins is here. Otherwise, he'd be too expensive to play for the Warriors, who are already stocked with pricey stars. There's a cap on how much teams can spend on salaries. Cousins was a perennial all-star for the Sacramento Kings and then the New Orleans Pelicans. 6'11" and skilled. But on January 26th, 2018, he wrecked his leg.
DeMarcus Cousins is injured at the other end.
Cousins ruptured his left Achilles tendon. It would require surgery and a year to rehabilitate. He might never be the same player. That, coupled with a rep for having a bad attitude, kept many teams from wanting to sign him. But not the Warriors. They got him for one season at a huge discount. And after returning from rehab mid-season, he was proving his worth, getting back into his old form, playing hard. So there he is, Monday night, in only his second playoff game ever, chasing down a steal. But as he runs, he stumbles. That left leg he spent so long fixing gives out, and he collapses again.
And you hope that Cousins is not hurt because he's staying down on the floor on the defensive end, grabbing his left hip area.
He struggles to stand up, and then he heads straight for the locker room.
He has to come out, Marv, and I don't know if the team.
The Warriors might have to get it done without him.
He looks very frustrated running to the.
This is Bounce. I'm Ben Trefney, and we're covering the Golden State Warriors' last season in Oakland before they head to San Francisco. It's not just about the drama of the playoffs. It's also about what the move means to the community so deeply invested in this team. We'll get to that, but first, let's finish up Game 2. When DeMarcus Cousins goes down, his teammates don't miss a beat. They dominated the first game of the series, and they still look unstoppable. Early in the third quarter, they build a 31-point lead. It's a blowout. The games are four quarters long.
Lou Williams corner again.
Oh my. The Clippers get the lead down to 20.
Gallo with his own rebound.
Then it's down to 10.
Harrell has a chance to make it a single digit.
It's 5.
But into Harrell, he dunks it down.
It's tied.
The 31-point lead is gone.
The Clippers take the lead with 15 seconds left. And the Warriors never get it back.
And what an incredible win for the LA Clippers. They even the series at 1-1.
It's the worst playoff collapse in NBA history by one of the biggest favorites ever. It's just one game. It takes four to win the series. But afterwards, shooting guard Klay Thompson says the loss of the team's big man is devastating.
Hoping for a speedy recovery because we really need him if we want to make this run.
The next day, DeMarcus Cousins gets an MRI, and his worst fears are realized. Torn left quadriceps. He'll have to undergo another long rehab before playing again. It's heartbreaking for him. And the Warriors almost certainly won't have him for the rest of the playoffs. One thing is for certain, though. The fans will come. and so will the people who make a living off of them. That's where we're going to turn our attention now. Oracle Arena is right near Oakland's Coliseum BART station. It's really easy for folks from all over the Bay Area to get to games. The bridge that connects the BART station to the arena is a fan funnel, which makes it the perfect place for unofficial vendors to cash in. Marco Silo Gonzalez has more.
Head down the stairs from the train platform, walk through the toll gates, hustle up another two flights to the bridge, and Daryl Stepp is there waiting for you. In a white silk shirt, tight braided hair, and a welcoming smile.
Selling beer and water. That's what I do. I don't have no job, so this is how I make my living. Pays the bills.
It's not legal. Selling alcohol without a permit is a misdemeanor in California, and three BART officers are just down the stairs. But the bridge seems to be some kind of neutral territory between BART and the Coliseum.
Like right here, we're right here on their property, you know. Usually they, you know, they don't mind, you know.
But sometimes they do. And when they catch him, it comes with a price.
What they do is they pour your beer out. Sometimes they'll take your money. So we do pay taxes. It's all in the game.
Daryl takes his chances. He sells beer for $3 a can and water for $2. He usually gets out with $150 a night. But those profits are uncertain with the Warriors' upcoming move to the Chase Center.
Well, it depends on how the law reacts, you know, because, you know, they got a little stricter laws in San Francisco than Oakland. So it depends what happens. You know, I mean, if they're real strict, I might have to get 3 or 4 blocks, maybe 5 blocks away from the stadium.
Daryl says he started selling drinks in 2010 at Candlestick Park and followed the crowds when the team left for Levi Stadium. So for him, a franchise moving across town is just a part of the game. Soon after we talk, Daryl moves his operation directly in front of the BART toll gates. The three officers march swiftly from outside the station towards him. Right away, Daryl slams his cooler shut and speedwalks towards the opposing exit, probably avoiding another ticket. The bridge is a festive walkway to the game. A drummer bangs a rhythm while plenty of other people sell things, like the pair of men who've commanded the peanut stand for years. A few people have carts with bacon-wrapped hot dogs and grilled veggies. One person selling caps and beanies that aren't officially licensed by the Warriors. Some others have a table displaying an array of t-shirts for $10 a pop.
Yeah, my name's Enrique Barreto.
Enrique's from San Francisco. He's actually selling gear with his mom and dad, and has for years.
Man, for a while, as long as I can remember, pretty much.
Warriors games aren't his only gig.
Look, I'd be in San Francisco too at the Giants games and everything, so you know what I mean? Because we all just sell the Warriors stuff. And we sell Giants, and we sell A's, and, you know, Raiders, Niners. So that's what I'm saying, everybody. The Golden State Warriors, and like kind of like a melting pot.
So he's not too broken up about the Dubs crossover.
I mean, yeah, of course we're going to miss this, but, yeah, we got to go. It's not like, you know, it's not that far. It's right there, you know. We just get on BART, and we over there, same thing.
Most fans pass the vendors without stopping, but they can't ignore this guy blowing his sacks.
Okay, I'm Raul. I'm the horn player up here on the bridge that you hear bouncing and pumping. And, you know, I'm your hype man when you leave. Juice up your stuff, whether you win or lose. You know, win, lose, or draw.
Raul's not playing around. Performing on the bridge for almost 27 years, he's made a good chunk of change.
I've made over $100,000 up here. I can pay my bills and pay rent. I'm an American because of this. You understand what I'm saying? This is serious.
It's not all about the money. Raul says he came up in Oakland, got his education here, and played all over the world.
People see me playing out here and they think, wow, what happened? What happened is I did everything I was supposed to do, and now I'm here giving back. That's what happened. So it's a beautiful thing.
It's not easy work, though. Raul says all the folks working on the bridge are going to be in a tight spot once the Warriors leave.
A lot of people up here hustling, and it's honest work. It's hard work. It's not easy. That's going to be gone. A lot of that's gone. Then what are people going to do?
The Warriors' move to San Francisco represents a huge socioeconomic leap from their home in deep East Oakland. Raul says Oakland can't afford the team's absence. The neighborhood that surrounds Oracle Arena is largely made up of extremely low-income Black and Hispanic folks. The area has a median household income of about $25,000 a year, one of the poorest in the Bay.
You know, we need what we have just to maintain. And we can't afford to lose the Raiders and the Warriors. And you know what I mean? It's just, it's killing us, man.
The Warriors' new stadium in the Mission Bay neighborhood of San Francisco is predominantly white and Asian. A little more than half of the households there make over $100,000 a year. Raul says he expects to follow the Warriors over to San Francisco. This is his main income, so he doesn't really have a choice.
I'll probably go over there. I do not like the city. It's just very difficult. And it's like $11.50 for me to get there and back. So, I mean, you know, transportation, location, 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 you know. So anyway, Warriors, G, man, we're going to miss you. That's all I can say.
That story was reported by Marco Seiler Gonzalez with help from Shireen Adel, Lena Joy, and Bo Walsh. Next time on Bounce.
An unbelievable story. A team that wasn't even supposed to make the playoffs. Here they are, battling in the seventh game, trying to beat the Chicago Bulls to take on Washington. And out they come, one by one, Al Adel's Warriors.
We'll return to the Warriors' start in Oakland back in the 1970s, trace the team's wilderness years, and see how they built their current dynasty. And we'll find out why one of sports' best fan bases stuck with them through one of basketball's all-time playoff droughts.
Oh, there was always hope. There was always light at the end of the tunnel. There was always thinking that the Warriors was going to get better and they was going to get a key player.
Faith can be rewarded.
That's Ben Trefney, host of the new KLW podcast, Bounce, following the Golden State Warriors and the culture and community around them in their last days in Oakland. You can subscribe to Bounce wherever you get your podcasts, and make sure to catch the upcoming episode next Wednesday right here on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Oakland artist Michael Orange grew up hearing stories of how his grandfather, a college librarian, hosted distinguished artists in his home. Orange is continuing that legacy in his work as founder and curator of arts events, including Matatu, an arts festival featuring Black creatives from the Bay Area and around the world. Named after the rural share taxis in Kenya, he calls the Matatu Festival a, quote, cultural experience vehicle that takes you on global journeys through performance. Matatu is in its sixth year now. Michael Orange shared how it all got started with KLW's Janae Darden.
I am a full-time thinker. It's always been difficult for me when, you know, you're at that point on the date and it's like, hey, what do you like to do with your time? What do you like to do? You know, bowling, things like this. And I generally have a tough time getting past that part of, you know, and it's not really sexy to, you know, say that, but I like to think. It's out there.
It's out there.
It's visceral. My grandparents were faculty at a number of universities, but in particular at Lincoln University in Missouri, my grandfather's role was librarian, which is really fascinating to consider what librarians were then. And what he would do is he was the one charged with bringing people like Duke Ellington or other notable figures to campus. So I've heard stories about, you know, Jimmy staying at the house, who that's who he was then, but now we know him as
James Baldwin.
Uh-huh. And my mom has a story about she and her friends all being in the kitchen on tiptoe, like listening in on the conversation that was happening out in the living room. When I moved to Oakland, I did not have an impression of the art scene because I wasn't privy to it, much like many people who were moving to the Bay Area, in particular, Black folk from all around the world, they'd moved here, yet they didn't necessarily know where to find it. As is the case with people who are moving here from places all over the world today, who have heard this thing about Oakland, and they get here and they say, cool, well, where is it? Or they get to the Bay Area, they say, cool, where is it? And let me say that that's a good thing, right? Like, and perhaps that's a strategy as well. Like, we don't want, you know, want to give everyone access to our centers. So then there was this art program, this opening on August 8th, 2008, which was called 888 Pieces of We. And it was a program at ProArts, and it was the opening of Kay Bacante's new exhibition on his birthday, August 8th. And so it was there that I first encountered this particular aesthetic of people whom I admire and wanted to surround myself with. Yet, and at the same time, it harkened back to the environment in which I was raised in North Carolina, spending time at the, you know, our family friends founded the North Carolina Black Repertory Theater. Those are a lot of the people who groomed me, and they went on to, that became the National Black Theater Festival, the largest black theater festival, at least in our country. And so it kind of replicated that feeling, and I felt quite at home.
Tell us, what is Matatu?
So Matatus are found in East Africa in a nation that today we call Kenya, in a center of that place called Nairobi. And Matatus are traditionally the people's bus. So this has been a form of unregulated transportation that governs its own routes and its own times outside of the influence of the municipality. These are vehicles that travel where regulated transportation will not go. It will go deep into the rural places and bring you all the way as far as the central business district, depending on where you would like to go. But they're not all necessarily tethered to the central business district. I like the idea of Matatus. I selected that name because I feel like story is the same.
And I noticed with Matatu is that you don't stick to just one genre of art. There's poetry, there's dance, there's film. It's eclectic, which reminds me of those buses that bring community together, but there's so much difference within it, but everybody has this one destination, right?
Sure. The poet is that one guy on the bus.
Yeah.
That's saying some interesting things.
Yeah.
Right. Like you're saying, each of these buses have their own identity. One thing I'm excited about is we recently partnered with Kay Bacante and Red Bay Coffee Roasters to bring forth the Nomadic Cinema. Red Bay Coffee is the largest Black-owned specialty coffee roaster in our nation. It has also become a community center in Oakland, certainly, but also known throughout the Bay Area. So it makes a lot of sense to bring story into the same room that is working with these beans that are touched by people from the continent, and we bring people together around stories.
It's a beautiful space, too. It's in East Oakland.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Story, to me, is the fourth most precious resource known to man. Everything has a story. To me, everyone has a spectacular story, in the words of my brother Amir Suleiman. And there are no rules to your story. You can tell it however you like. You can be as dusty as you'd like, or it can be as fanciful as you like. And so I employ that as a metaphor for the programs that I create. So I'm excited about, you know, the stories that we've projected this year, and in particular with Nomadic Cinema. We are excited about presenting Mdou Mokhtar again from the Nation of Niger. We're presenting a film that he's starring in, which is a remake of Prince's Purple Rain, except told by the Tuareg people of the Sahara. And then after, he'll be in a musical performance. We're not doing this for entertainment. We do believe that SMART can be fun too. And it's an opportunity to, I suppose, have another look at U.S. foreign policy from the gaze of those of us living on the other side of it. This is what he had to say about the current state of things in Niger. For 48 years, France has exploited the uranium in our country, and yet we still don't have roads, medicines, and in many places, there is no water or electricity. France says we are independent now, but we have no independence. We are modern slaves. They say this is an Africa problem, but we have had enough of what France is doing to us. It's as if we're still in the 15th century. So we will come together and we will sing and dance and watch and laugh and these sorts of things. Yet it's really an invitation for people to come together.
Some people are saying we're, right now, we're living in an age of a new black arts renaissance in Oakland. And I'm sure people would list you as part of that new Black Arts Renaissance. What do you think? Do you think we're living in a new Black Arts Renaissance?
Renaissance is a charged word, and frankly, I don't think it's our word. I think it's a word we're conveniently repeating, just like the way we refer to art. I don't think that's our word. This idea that we just began? No, we didn't. You know, we've been doing. So I don't feel, and I've always resisted these ideas of Renaissance. In particular, when you start seeing the word Renaissance, you know, float to the surface, look at what happens a year or 2 years within that window. I feel that if there is a Black arts movement that is more visible in Oakland right now, then I feel that that makes a lot of sense considering how our presence has been diluted. It would then be more visible. It would become that thread that can dominate the entire, even though you've only woven it into the fabric two or three times. So no, I personally don't feel we're amidst a renaissance at all. It might be the case that there is a collective sense of urgency that I feel like artists that see themselves as being Black are aligning with an urgency in having another look at their differences, pooling their resources. I don't think, though, that that's the byproduct of beauty. I think that that's a matter of survival.
That was executive director and founder of Matatu, Michael Orange, speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. Matatu's next performance is by singer-songwriter Mdu Mokhtar. That's tomorrow night at Red Bay Coffee in Oakland. You can check out the full schedule at klw.org. And make sure you're subscribed to the Cross Currents newsletter. Get all our stories and interviews and more every week right in your inbox. And we're staying in Oakland for our local music for today. This is Grex. They're performing at the Center for New Music on Thursday night. Cross Currents team includes Magnolia McKay, Kevin McLean, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega-Welch, True Quinn, and Eli Wertschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Hadil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. She's high.